So my name is Peter Veresh. I'm a postdoc at UAH, and of course I thank very much the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk here. So I'm going to talk about our observations of GRB 1708-17A. I'm giving this talk on behalf of the GBM LIGO working group, and what makes us a group is that we share our subthreshold data. So the LIGO gives us their subthreshold gravitational wave data, or rather their trigger times, and we give them our subthreshold gamma ray data. So the things are, the observations are summarized here in these papers. Is this working? So I missed my flight on Monday, so that's why I couldn't be here on the very, very interesting talks, but I was somehow, to some extent, also happy because my son decided to take his first steps there. So there you go. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about GRBs, because I don't know how up to date are you with the GRB physics or observations. So we at the GBM we observe gamma rays about a few times a week, and this is our latest catalog. It's a bit old now, and it contains, now we are at about 2,200 GRBs. They are distributed isotropically on the sky, and with me. And there's a distribution of their durations, and there are two humps in their distribution. We call them short, typically about a bit less than 1 second, and they're the long GRBs, a few tens of sec, peak at a few tens of seconds. And the prompt emission consists, if we look at the spectra, consists of a broken power law called the band spectrum, here in green. And for brighter bursts, we can find thermal like components at lower energies. And in even brighter bursts, there's sometimes an additional power law, which still begs understanding. Okay, we have their light curves. They are variable, very, very unique. Each of them is very unique. So their variability, the time scale in which they vary goes down to almost 10 milliseconds, and they're followed by a longer wavelength afterglow. They can span up to weeks and sometimes even longer. This is, of course, I forgot to put the reference here. This is from Dan Perley's nice fitting of GRB 1704-17A. One of the brightest GRBs so far, with, I guess it's comparable, the data set is comparable to what we have for our burst now here. Okay, so what we deduce from all these observations, we have prompt emission going from KeV to a bit under MeV. That's where the bulk of the energy is emitted, and we have the afterglow spanning from radio to just below the TeV range. Okay, and from all that I have presented, we know that we must have a compact object, and there's a jet emitted pointing towards us with opening angles of a few degrees, with isotropic energy spanning from 10^15, 10^55 Hertz. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Fermi GBM, the glass gamma ray burst monitor. We have two sets of instruments. One is the NAI, sensitive at lower energies. This is what triggered this GRB. So here you see the scheme of this. They're pointed in different directions of the sky, and there's the BGOs, sensitive at a bit higher energies. Okay? And we are working 87% of the time. We have to turn off because we have to turn off when we pass the South Atlantic anomaly. And we see, at any given time, we see the entire unocculted sky, and that's about 67%. That if you do some simulations, we can state that any given point in the sky is exposed to us about a bit more than 60% of the time. Okay, so what our bread and butter are the triggers, and that we consider a trigger when the rate of the gamma rays exceeds the background, and we have different trigger algorithms, and we see about 40 short GRBs per year. Triggering is done automatically by the spacecraft computer, and in addition to triggering, we have two additional methods to detect GRBs. These are called offline searches, and those are designed to increase the sensitivity. So this is done in real time. The triggering is done in real time by the onboard spacecraft computer, and the offline searches are done on data that is downloaded later and have higher resolution, and we have better computing power to distinguish the background and so on. So one of the offline searches we call a targeted search, and that is which we use to discover the curious GRB that followed the first gravitational wave event. So this is very computationally intensive, and we only do that for interesting objects to give you a sense of how intensive it is. So we analyze chunks of 60 seconds, and that chunks of analyzing 60 seconds of data takes about 30 minutes. So we can't do it can't do it all the time. There's a so-called untargeted search, which just agnostically searches for excess with better background modeling and better understanding of the data than the onboard computer. And that produces, we run this search on all our data, and that discovers an extra 80 short GRBs per year. So we have about 40, and this gives us about 80 extra. It's a single processor, but it's, as far as I understand, it's difficult to parallelize. So, yes, I understand that. For some reason, it's not feasible, or at least we haven't done that. It's not. We are trying to work out the background issues and what the non-results mean to us. Okay, so the way we localize GRBs will be important because you will see why. We compare the rates in different detectors, and we know in which way they point. And just by their response, we can nail the location on the sky of the GRBs. Okay, so let me walk you through what happened on August 17th. The first. The gravitational wave happened. The gravitational wave trigger occurred, and it was followed by about 2 seconds by the gamma ray burst trigger. So first, about 16 seconds later, the onboard algorithm identified that there's a GRB and sent out a public alert that, hey, there's a GRB. You might wanna watch out. Okay, and then about 27 seconds later, still the onboard computer localized it and classified it as a GRB with high probability. About 40 seconds later, some data was sent already to the ground computers, and the ground computers localized it to some accuracy. Those localizations are not the best ones. So let's let's just say they're not the best ones. So about 40 seconds, oh, sorry, about 40 minutes later, the LVC put out, the LIGO Virgo consortium put out the notice that they saw neutron star merger, and they already knew that there was a coincident GRB trigger because all these were public. So this alert was sent to the private LIGO EM list. Okay, so then we started scrambling and did the a little bit better location, what we can do a bit better location by hand. So we sent out in about 45 minutes later a human guided location. Then there was when we sent this out, we only had the single interferometer localization on the sky for the gravitational wave, and it was encouraging that even though the single interferometer location is just the antenna pattern on the sky, it was still broadly consistent. So at point, the most probable region was about this much. So this is the sky map is actually the final sky map, but the initial localization was about this big, and our location was about here. So you can see these are the normals of our three closest detectors here, and this is our final localization map, and this is zoomed in here. This is the final LIGO region, and this is the place of the location of the kilonova. So about an hour later, we reported publicly the properties of the GRBs, and about 5 hours later, the final or the almost final LIGO location map came in, and that's when we knew there must be surely associated because of this. So you may ask how likely is that they are not associated? So we calculated the significance. So first we do the how likely they are not associated based on the rate of gamma ray bursts. So this is the LIGO signal, this is the GRB signal. So how likely is it that GRB happens 2 seconds around a gravitational wave just by chance? And that's your probability, 5 × 10⁻⁶. And the other question you may ask, how likely is it that a gravitational wave happens this close to a GRB localization region? And that comes out to be about 1%. And if you multiply the two, you get about 5.3 sigma probability. Okay, so there's a basic fact sheet on GRB 1708-17A. So GRBs are brightest in this energy range, 50 to 300 kV. That's where our instrument looks for them. And this particular GRB was triggering this quarter second time scale. So we look for many different time scales, but this particular GRB triggered on a quarter second time scale. And when we look into the data in detail, we can say that it started not 2 seconds after the gravitational wave trigger, but 1.7 seconds. We modeled the pulse shape. And so we do the duration of this GRB. So we ask how long it lasts. So it comes out to be 2 seconds. So it's surprising because if you look at this light curve, you see it, there are two bins here. It must be about 0.5 seconds. So what happens here? So what happens is that there is the main component is indeed about 0.5 seconds, but there is a soft emission following this main component, which bumps up its head just about enough to skew the duration. So I'll talk about it in a little bit. So there's an additional component which makes the duration longer than it's visible by just by looking at the light curve. So we have a main peak and some component that it's really, really soft. So you may ask, is this component related to the GRBs? The answer is yes. We have did the localization on this component, so photons coming from this soft peak, and it localizes this to the same region on the sky as the main GRB. Okay, so you may heard that soft and long GRBs are divided at 2 seconds. That's the normal understanding. So you may ask, if this GRB is 2 seconds long, is this really a short GRB? And the answer is yes, more likely than not. It's not as, so we can do better than just saying longer or shorter than 2 seconds. We can take the catalog, model the distribution by two Gaussians. It turns out that it's best modeled by two Gaussians. And if we put the two plus or minus 0.5 seconds on this distribution, it turns out that it's about three, the probability of being short is about proportional three to one compared to them being long, okay? And of course, this is a very conservative assumption because the emission is at most 2 seconds, not likely to be more. So it's rather on the to the left of this diagram to this point. Okay, so we do spectral analysis of this burst. We do two types of spectral analysis. First, the spectral analysis we do for every gamma ray burst. We can compare in context of other bursts. So then, and then we go look deeper into the data and identify the emission episodes and do a more detailed analysis. So we just, this is not so important, maybe look at these bottom two lines. So we have the main 0.5 second component that is described by a so-called Comptonized model that is basically a power law, here seen in green power law, and an exponential cutoff at high energies. So the peak energy is about 200 keV, and there's a soft component is best described by a black body with a temperature of about 10 keV. Okay, so this is to see how this GRB fares compared to the other GRBs. So we plot here the fluence. So some parameters like the fluence, the energy, the time integrated flux, the 64 millisecond peak flux of our observed gamma ray burst, E peak, spectral index, and so on. This is another E peak, another spectral index. So the black is the distribution of short GRBs, and the dashed is distribution of long GRBs. And this is where our burst falls in this distribution. So you see in terms of fluence, it's an average burst. In terms of E peak, it's on the weaker side. So it's a dimmer and softer burst than short GRBs, but it's not outstandingly dim or outstanding. It's an ordinary short GRB. And what makes it special in our mind is this weak soft emission. It may turn out that it's so weak that we haven't even noticed so far, and that's why we didn't search for it. Okay, so let me give you some interpretation. As I said, this is an ordinary GRB in terms of observations. But when you include the distance information, turns out it's dimmer or less luminous by orders of magnitude, like two or three orders of magnitude dimmer than the dimmest short GRB observed so far. So this would tell you most naturally that this is an off-axis GRB, so a GRB that is viewed from an angle larger than the jet opening angle, or because it's so close, I think it's either the closest or the and closest GRB, it's an intrinsically dim GRB viewed on axis. Okay, so these are the two interpretations we put forward in our papers in very, very simple terms. So how can we say anything about off-axis GRBs? First, we just do this very simple top-head jet viewed off-axis, and we relate the observed properties like the duration or the peak energy to we relate the observed duration to the duration that would have been observed if we were on axis. So we assume that all the GRBs are viewed on axis, and we compare this observation to the other one. So this, for that, we define this parameter B, which is just basically the ratio of Doppler factors for on and off axis observations. So theta G here, theta G J here, just tells you the jet opening angle, and that theta V gives you the viewing angle. Okay, so from gravitational wave observation, this is really amazing that we could put such a constraining limits on the viewing angle from gravitational wave observations only if we assume Hubble constant. If we assume the highest Hubble constant from our previous observations, we get a 36 degrees viewing angle constraint upper limit. And if we assume the lower Hubble constant, we get a 28 degree upper limit. So what we do, this exercise is just shows that this is what we observe, and we assume it's off axis. So this is the E peak, E iso, and duration. And this is the how E peak goes as a function of this B parameter, which includes the Lorentz factor and the viewing angle difference squared. So we want them to be a normal GRB if we viewed it off on axis. So then we can play around with this B parameter. So if we take this B parameter to be about 30, we can have sort of normal E peak. It's a bit high. Sort of normal E iso and sort of normal T90, but this is on the short side. Okay, and to get there, we need to assume for a Lorentz factor of 300, which is supposedly normal for short GRBs, we need to assume a viewing angle which is very close to the edge, which makes it very unlikely. If we take a Lorentz factor of 30, which is on the lower side, then it's a bit more realistic. The angle is about 10 degrees that we need to view it off axis. Okay, so how so this is a bit involved plot, and just shows you this off-axis scenario has some problems. And so here you can see that for a fixed viewing angle, so we fix the viewing angle at 28 degrees, it's on the x-axis is the jet opening angle, and the y-axis are the three observables I've talked about. So this E iso normalized, so this just scales compared to the normal, to the normalized value 10 to the 51, for a short GRB, 0.3 for a T90, and 600 keV for the EP. So this just factors of how much it deviates if it were to be viewed on axis for our GRB. So red is E iso, blue is E peak, and green is T90. So thin lines is low Lorentz factor, 40, medium thick line is 100, Lorentz factor of 100, and very thick line is Lorentz factor of 300. And so there's dashed lines and there's continuous lines. Dashed lines show that there wasn't any GRBs observed there at that parameter, and thick lines indicate the region where GRBs have been observed. So these are the extremes here and there, and this is the extreme short duration that has been observed. So these arrows indicate the region of parameter space which would have been allowed, and you can see that it's really, you have to be really close to the jet. So these angles of it are only of a few degrees. Okay, so I just put up some miscellaneous topics that I would like to cover here. So first, this is the first interpretation, that we are viewing the jet off axis. But at the time, we didn't know about the X-ray observations, and we speculated how can this observation be explained if we were on axis. So it should be an intrinsically dim GRB. But the problem is that there is this black body coming after the non-thermal peak. So usually the black body comes either earlier or at the same time as the non-thermal peak coming from the photosphere, right? That's the conventional understanding of the GRB spectrum. But so the way we could, this, so the way we explain this is, as the jet propagates, it first, before it becomes optically thin to create the photosphere, it first creates an external shock, and then it becomes optically thin. So that's one explanation how we can get the thermal peak after the non-thermal one. Okay, so then there's the speed of gravity calculation that might have been covered yesterday. So that if they so we can set limits on the difference between the speed of photons and speed of gravity. If they have started out at the same time and gravity just was faster, so there's a delay of 1.7 seconds, we can set this limit. And if we assume that the photons started out later and just made up the difference to 1.7 seconds, we can set this limit. So this is just an assumption based on photospheric models, very extreme assumption, and we can set this lower limit. But the main point here is the many, many orders of magnitude to which we can constrain the speed of light, the speed of gravity compared to speed of light. So then the other topic is for O3, the expectations are about 1 to 50 binary neutron star observations per year, and that's the limit, that's the expectation of joint detections. And for design sensitivity, 6 to 100, 120 binary neutron stars, and only order one joint observations. So you may ask, how dim should this GRB have been? So we still triggered on it. So the answer is, if it were 30% dimmer, we would have still triggered on it. And that's interesting because generally you think of the LIGO horizon being very much smaller than our horizon for GRBs, and this was the other way around. So our horizon was less than the LIGO horizon. For the untargeted search, if this GRB were half as bright, we would have still detected it with some significance, enough to report it. And if it were 60% dimmer, the targeted search would have still found it. So Duncan told me that this question would arise. So this is a very preliminary result here. The question is, if this is a GRB, and it must mean that we are seeing similar GRBs there are in our data. And there's a search going on by Andreas von Kienlen, and he's doing the paper, is doing the analysis, searching for bursts that are relatively short, of order 1 second, and that are followed by some soft component. And so far, in the GBM sample, we have about 2,200 GRBs, about 460 are short, and a very, very initial search found a handful of GRBs of order 10 that look something like this. This is another GRB, a short spike followed by a soft component. There's the other archive by Batsy, which has a lot more GRBs and a lot higher percentage of short bursts. And there are promising candidates there too. So these are four channel light curves here. These are low energy channels, and this is the highest energy channel. You can see the short spike, and there's some soft emission here. Okay, so I arrived to my conclusions. So the main point is that GBM can detect gravitational wave counterparts, and at least some short GRBs originate from neutron star mergers. What we can do with it, we can do a lot. We can give better neutron star short GRB rates. We can do more modeling. We can introduce the central engine parameters into our models. And we can do speed of gravity, Lorentz invariance, weak equivalence principle, and many, many more. Thank you for your attention.
Back to this question of analogs. So there are these short GRBs with extended emission, which have soft tails, but those are usually
much longer.
10 to 100 second soft yes. tails. So I guess the question is there a continuum of soft tails, or is it really the case that these stand out as being unusual?
I think these stand out because someone can correct me, but those the extended emission is not thermal emission. Right? Yes. I think these are special.
Sure. A short comment about what you said on the search. First of all, I think it's really good that you're doing this search. I would like to add another criterion to the search that may help you. It's also that the initial harder peak had a relatively low E peak relative to what we see in regular short gamma ray bursts. So I would add that parameter also to the search because it will reduce the amount of burst that you see.
That's a very good point.
And another small comment, I don't want to be the devil advocate, but I don't think it's conventional that all gamma ray bursts should have a thermal component in their light curve.
Not at all. of course, So the black body component shows up only, or it's...
It was never, according to what I know, it was never seen in short gamma ray burst.
It has been seen. I know that for a fact, it has been seen.
Okay, but in this particular case, it's quite likely that it comes from a different origin, so...
Well, sure. But your first point, you're right. So we should search on low E peak GRBs to get more of these, but we don't want to constrain ourselves first, but then we can go there.
Yeah, you should use that to narrow down after.
But what did you mean by that the short GRBs are not followed by thermal components?
I'm saying that it's not likely that it comes also from the same origin of the prompt, same location.
I agree. Yeah, that's right.
So a couple of questions, one a bit more on the data and the other one a bit more on the final point. So you showed the two components, you showed us the fits, but you didn't actually show the data, the actual spectrum, the observed one. So you know, I'm just wondering how robust
this is not the thermal component, but this is the thermal component. So we went in and tried every kind of spectra available to us, like simple power loss, Comptonized and black body band function, everything. Just the thermal component is statistically preferred by many orders of magnitude.
And then, you know, you mentioned the tests on the relative speed of gravity and electromagnetic radiation, and that was mentioned yesterday. And those limits look very impressive. But I'm just wondering, you know, what do they actually mean in the context of actual physical theories in terms of, you know, what is the number that one would want to get to rule out alternative theories of something?
I guess I'm the wrong person to ask that question.
So I don't know if somebody else has.
Well, maybe I can comment. So a whole bunch of them have been ruled out already by, so these are some scalar tensor theories in gravity would introduce a much larger difference. But okay, did you put much stock in them to begin with? That's a different story. But some have been killed.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the why it's so slow to do the search? Why the analysis is so slow? No, just what is the bottleneck?
Which analysis? Searching for similar GRBs?
No, the 30 minutes time you mentioned it earlier.
So the way it works is there's a code, and you input a time in which you're interested, say the time of arrival of a gravitational wave signal. So the code does is tiles the whole sky in 1 square degree points and assumes that the signal is coming from each point and assumes spectra that cover the whole that cover a wide range of GRB spectra, and it convolves it with the, sees how it would look in our data, so it convolves with the detector response. That takes about 30 minutes. We are working on shortening that time.
So I wanted to ask if this cocoon mechanism were nearly isotropic,
yes.
Possibility would be that most LIGO binary neutron star detections would be associated with a very weak gamma ray burst. I just wanted to ask about that possibility.
So you mean the cocoon, the main pulse is the cocoon in this question? So there's a non-thermal part, the main 0.5-second peak, and there's a more extended 1-second long thermal.
So rather than just being slightly off axis, the cocoon may generate a nearly isotropic.
We believe that the cocoon is nearly isotropic, yes. So in that sense, but that sense you're right, Ben, the cocoon is really weak. So that it's about 1/3 of the energy of this intrinsically low brightness burst.
I think this is the problem you alluded to, right? That this is a case where our horizon and LIGO is bigger than the GBM horizon for these for these weak signals. So,
yes.
So what's limiting the, when our rate goes up and their rate stays roughly the same, it's the GBM sensitivity that's the limiting factor.
For this class of low luminosity.
So how do we raise the gamma ray burst horizon?
With our targeted search, so if you say that there's a gravitational wave signal, we can look, and we are working on, so in our search, we input these non-thermal non-thermal spectral shapes, because that's what we expect the GRB spectrum to be. But now we are working on inputting a black body, because now we know that there might be a black body also.
And you would have seen it to about twice the distance, roughly, right?
Roughly,
so 80,
right.
Maybe 90 megaparsecs. Yes. So that's
still within the light.
440 to get to the horizon.
Yeah. We'd support that too. Yes.
Yeah. So about the Kokunshak breakout model, in this model we don't expect the huge time variation in the main pulse or so. Can you comment on the what is the limit of the time variation in the main pulse in the?
So the main pulse? Yes, the main pulse is about 0.5 seconds long, and there's no variability per se. Like we see variability on bright bursts that you can clearly see a pulse, and on the pulse there are highly significant variations. Here we have only a weak pulse, and the variations at top of the pulse are consistent with noise. So what we can say is that the variability time is bounded by the rise time of the pulse, which is about 0.2 seconds. Yep. Oh.
Hold on.
So according to what I understood, there is a chance that you missed a whole lot of these events just because you made a template fitting to different types of spectra, and this type of spectra you did not foresee. So there's a chance that there is a whole bunch of these things buried in your data that you didn't detect?
I won't answer yes to that
question. Well, maybe weaker, not as strong as this.
Well,
but
I can imagine a very weak that we would have missed if we weren't doing the black body template. But even so, we are using a soft template which can mimic the black body, which actually found the black body here.
Mm-hmm. Is there a point in going back to the archival data and look for these types of events now that you know more what to look for?
I think that's what we're doing. Good question.
So I guess there's no more questions, so we can go for an early lunch. Let's thank all the speakers again.